Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. My name is Dave Marshall and this is episode 87 on Archaeopteryx with Dennis Vooten of Polatsky University. Firstly, apologies again for the lack of interviews. Many of you will know that the UK's universities are on strike over pensions, and so lectures are cancelled, academics refusing to work, and so a few of our interviews went out of the window. Fortunately, we're not just focused on the UK, and so we've got a couple recorded now, and they'll be out in due time. Thanks to everyone that's been sending in requests. We do try to chase them all up, and we also try to stay on top of recent publications, and that's the case for this episode. Archaeopteryx is one of those fossils that everyone recognises, but in this interview, we get insights into what's going on inside of its bones and what that can tell us about how it was able to fly. As usual, we've got pictures on our website, and liking, sharing, and leaving reviews online anywhere you can will help more people find the show. We hope you enjoy this episode. Hi, Dennis. Thank you very much for coming on the show.
My pleasure.
Right. We would like to get to know a little bit about you first before we get into your research. So can you tell us, well, really just summarize who you are?
My name is Dennis Vooten. I'm originally Dutch. And since I was a child, I had a very big interest in natural sciences. I really liked astronomy. I like collecting minerals. I like paleontology. So I decided to study geology in Amsterdam. After that, I studied paleoclimatology, and I was fortunate enough to do my master project in Bonn in Germany with Professor Martin Zander on marine reptiles from the Netherlands, the Triassic of the Netherlands, to be specific. After that, I worked in archaeology for 5 years, and when I was 31, wow, I decided that I was seeking the satisfaction associated with academic research. So I applied for a PhD position in the Czech Republic to study crocodiles initially. Unfortunately, that project got cancelled. So I made a sort of second start there, returning to my beloved nothosaurs. And after half a year, I got invited in a project into Archaeopteryx. And that's the project we're talking about today, I think.
Cool. So I just want to explore a bit more about you. So what were you doing as an archaeologist for so long?
Yes. After I finished my studies, it was a bit challenging to find a position that I would just happily jump into and thought that would be something for the rest of my life. So I looked a bit further and I stumbled upon a vacancy to act as an prospector in archaeology in the Netherlands under the Malta Treaty. Before you want to build a house or do infrastructural works, a permit needs to exist that states that there is no archaeology left in the ground anymore. Mm-hmm. So I would go into the field, see if anything was there. If I would find archaeology, I would recommend more research. And, well, same as in paleontology, after the archaeological research is done, there is not a lot left in the field anymore. So that way I allowed other people to build their house or their buildings or park in garages.
And did you ever find anything cool?
I was particularly fascinated with the sort of local history of where I'm originally from, which is in the south of the Netherlands. And the topsoil there is Aeolian cover sand from the Pleistocene. So you could find archaeology from pretty much, well, every period that's represented in Western Europe. And my favorite finds would always be Stone Age artifacts. So flint, knapping tools, things like that. And I did find a few of them, but the biggest joy was always finding something in the field, for example, at the surface, and then recommending more research. And if our company would then be invited to do the follow-up research, I would always happily join again to see how close I was with my prediction of what would have been in the field, what would have been there in the past and what it actually looked like.
Oh, that's really interesting. And do you think if you weren't a paleontologist, you'd still be interested in this field and going down the historical route?
Well, I am definitely still interested in archaeology. It's just that, obviously, having studied geology, and I have to be honest, originally I really wanted to study astronomy, but my mathematics skills are not really up to that. Mm-hmm. So I still give some lectures in astronomy, and I really like to gaze up to the sky in the evening. But there's a lot of other things that I tried to play in a band when I was a student, thinking I was going to be a rock star. Well, that never really happened. And I'm also a massive petrol head, so I've also even considered doing something with car journalism. Wow. So whatever I've been doing, if I wasn't doing paleontology, I'm quite sure I would be very happy to do that as well.
You do look pretty metal. I think you'd fit in quite well in Slayer. I mean, I will admit I have a huge amount of beard jealousy for you. You've got an excellent beard. I wish everyone could see it right now.
Well, I always say that having a beard is some people put a lot of time into their appearance, and having a beard and long hair is sort of what happens if you don't put a lot of time into it. So I'm glad that it still looks sort of representative.
Excellent. Right. Let's get back on track. So how did you end up working with Archaeopteryx? I mean, you'd been talking about studying marine reptiles and you were doing history and all of that stuff. But then suddenly you're working on Archaeopteryx. Did someone come to you and say, hey, we've got this project? Or did you kind of seek it out and say, I want to work on Archaeopteryx?
Well, that's a very good question. It was a very happy coincidence. As I mentioned, I was originally envisioned to do a project on crocodiles, but it fell through. I was sort of left in the Czech Republic wanting to do a project on paleontology, but we don't have any paleontological expertise in-house. So I originally reached out to Dr. Paul Taffereau of the European Synchrotron Radiation Facility to see if he could maybe help me out to get my project on Nothosaur started by doing some X-ray scans of some selected specimens. And under his supervision, I worked on that for half a year. I got some promising results, but I also started to realize that if I was going to pursue the project that I originally planned, it would take me much longer than I was supposed to spend on a PhD. So yeah, when I discussed that with Paul, he mentioned that they were doing some technical experiments and they were trying to optimize the setup for specifically fossils that are encased in lithic slabs, in sort of flat fossils, we call them in general, because they offer particular challenges towards visualizing them with X-ray radiation. And actually, they were getting some reasonably good results. So there was definitely a future there. And then one day he asked me if I would be interested to join that project. And I believe he said it would give me a few days to think about it. But 1 second later, I had already agreed. And that's when my adventure with Archaeopteryx started.
Excellent. Well, we'll get into the details of the technical study that you did in a little bit. But first, I think it would be a good idea to introduce everyone to Archaeopteryx. I mean, do we need to introduce everyone to Archaeopteryx?
Maybe. The thing is, Archaeopteryx is quite famous. It's one of those iconic dinosaurs together with the raptors and Tyrannosaurus Rex. But I always think there's still quite a bit of confusion about what exactly is Archaeopteryx and what Archaeopteryx is not. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I would start by saying that Archaeopteryx is an elaborately feathered small dinosaur from present-day Bavaria in southeastern Germany. All Archaeopteryx, all true recognized Archaeopteryx fossils date back to the late Jurassic, so that's about 150 million years ago. And Archaeopteryx is actually quite famous historically as well. The first specimen was discovered only 2 years after Darwin published On the Origin of Species. And, it was a very elegant example of some of the processes that he proposed. And Archaeopteryx was also briefly mentioned in some later versions of that book. And actually, Thomas Huxley, sort of colloquially referred to as Darwin's bulldog, was the one that threw Archaeopteryx, and in comparison with Compsognathus, suggested that theropod dinosaurs may represent the ancestors of modern-day birds. And this transitional sort of status is really clearly visible if you look, for example, at the Berlin specimen of Archaeopteryx, which arguably is one of the most beautiful fossils in the world. And even from a distance, you can already see that it has a sort of bird-like plumage, especially the wings are very clearly preserved, and well, they resemble those of modern birds in more than just a few aspects. But if you start to look a bit closer, you can see that it still has a lot of sharp and pointy teeth in its mouth, and it still has claws on the wings. And obviously it also has the long bony tail of that's reminiscent of sort of ancestral dinosaurs. And yes, in this with this morphology and in this historical context, Archaeopteryx has played the final put the final piece of the puzzle together in the 70s when John Ostrom sort of again rekindled the Victorian theory of Huxley that birds are in fact dinosaurs. Initially, it was not really commonly accepted, but I would say today most of the people in our field sort of agree that indeed birds should be considered as the last living dinosaurs. And I would say that Archaeopteryx plays a very important role in that recognition.
It's often referred to as the first bird. Is that technically correct? Can we separate dinosaurs from birds? Is it more of a spectrum? And is saying it's the first bird kind of providing an arbitrary cutoff?
Well, as you know, we like to put things in boxes. We like to sort of categorize everything, including all our fossils. And obviously what we call something is not necessarily representative of what its absolute function or role in the past could have been, specifically in the evolution of, for example, dinosaurs to birds. Nowadays, a bird, the technical definition of a bird is the last common ancestor of all living birds and all of its descendants, which in practice is probably the last common ancestor of the house sparrow and of the ostrich and all of its descendants. And although this group does include a lot of birds that went extinct, obviously all animals, all birds that live today are the only ones that remain of this group. And Archaeopteryx is now considered the oldest potentially free-flying avialan. So that's a group that's been introduced to sort of refer to all animals that are more closely related to, again, the house sparrow of modern birds, if you will, than to Deinonychus, which is a dromaeosaur. And through this definition, I have to admit that I was initially also a bit surprised. I thought it was quite clear-cut. But having worked with theropods and focused on Archaeopteryx, I was actually surprised to see that although the large outline of groups is relatively consistent, if you start to zoom in on specific dromaeosaurs, specific avialans, specific Archaeopteryx like animals, we're not 100% sure where everything fits. So that's something that will require a bit of attention in the future.
What are some of the defining characteristics of birds? When would you say, right, this is a bird now?
Well, again, the technical definition is note-based. I have to apologize. I cannot present all the characters that define that specific group. But if you start to go back in time a bit, and we go a little bit before Archaeopteryx, evolutionary speaking, we're looking at one group that's called the Panaraptora, which is a group of dinosaurs that is known to be quite feathered. And, well, they come in all shapes and sizes. And within that group, we find the Paraves, which is sort of traditionally, as the name suggests, a group that's close to birds. The difference between Paraves and Panaraptora being that oviraptors are Panaraptora, but not Paravians. And then if we look within Paraves, well, obviously dromaeosaurs are the outgroup to all other Paravians. But it's been recently been shown that, for example, Velociraptor actually preserves little bumps on its ulna that we can also see in modern birds. And in modern birds, they appear to have a role in attaching and possibly controlling the flight feathers. So although we know Velociraptor was incapable of flight, there is definitely something going on there. So there's actually quite a large group preceding and surrounding the origin of, early birds or avialans that's still quite poorly understood. But what I can be very sure of is that having feathers is today not considered to be a specifically avian or even avialan characteristic.
Archaeopteryx isn't known from very many specimens. So do we have a problem in that if we were able to view more individuals, we'd get more information, might be able to see where it fits in the tree better?
Possibly. Obviously, Archaeopteryx is known. So if we want to contextualize it, it would help a lot if we have some close relatives, we'll be able to put them together in a tree, because it would greatly illuminate our understanding of that specific sort of period and that sort of phase. But I actually have to contest that there are not many specimens known, because today we know of 11 specimens, and obviously for some fossil taxa we have way, way more. But actually with 11 specimens more or less conclusively assigned to Archaeopteryx, it should give us something to work with. I mean, it has been shown that there is quite a bit of variability within Archaeopteryx, and colleagues in Munich and Switzerland have recently described that this may possibly originate through speciation, maybe on islands in the Solnhoven Lagoon, something along those lines. But yeah, to answer your question, I would say we don't have a few. We actually do have quite a bit of material, but returning to the fact that they actually share characters, but they are also quite different in other aspects, does indeed, it would greatly help if we would get more specimens on the table, for sure.
Do we fully understand what Archaeopteryx look like? Do we have complete fossils, or have we kind of pieced together what Archaeopteryx look like from loads of different fragments?
No, from the 11 specimens known of Archaeopteryx, a few of them are actually quite or almost nearly complete. So for those specific individuals, we have quite a good idea of how the skeleton comes together. We have found one fossil I've studied is an isolated right wing, although it lacks certain diagnostic characters for Archaeopteryx because they're based on parts other than the wing. We cannot be 100% sure that it's also Archaeopteryx, but the same colleagues I just mentioned at least suggest that it is Archaeopteryx indeed. And actually, through this relatively well-understood set, the same colleagues have recently also removed one Archaeopteryx from the list. In the Netherlands, we had this specimen that was not recognized as Archaeopteryx the first, but was technically discovered or unearthed the first. In the 70s, John Ostrom thought it was an Archaeopteryx because before that people thought it was a pterodactyl fossil. He hauled the fossil up to the light and saw the imprint of feathers. So there's a very famous story about how the curator then said, walked away with the fossil, leaving Ostrom behind, leaving Ostrom afraid he would not be able to work on it anymore. And then the curator came back with a shoebox and said, "Thank you very much. You've made our museum famous." Well, and the specimen is famous, is back in the news now, because our colleagues have shown that through the proportion preserved in this relatively poorly or incompletely preserved specimen, that it's likely an anchiornid or a relative of anchiornids. So it's actually the first or the closest relative to Archaeopteryx that's not an Archaeopteryx itself that has been discovered in Solnhoven and could have been sympatric, so living alongside Archaeopteryx. But no, for the rest, it's relatively clear what an Archaeopteryx is and what is not an Archaeopteryx. However, the variation inside Archaeopteryx is still posing some challenges to explain sufficiently.
And I think that brings us quite masterfully to your study. What is it that you were looking to do? What hypotheses were you testing?
Well, obviously, with Archaeopteryx being such an iconic taxon, and although I just explained that Archaeopteryx itself is not a bird, it does provide some very important information on sort of the ancestral or earliest modes of dinosaurian flight. I went to the literature because I became quite fascinated with this taxon. And what I noticed is that a lot of very, very good work is done on flight capabilities in Archaeopteryx. But what I noticed is that most of them are based on descriptions of particular properties of Archaeopteryx that may or may not be compatible with flight, and specifically modern bird flight. Although, on the other hand, it was already quite clear that the exact flight of modern birds is not really compatible with the shoulder of Archaeopteryx. So I was really trying to find some proxy some lead that would be independent from earlier reasonings and would provide a record of flight or something that would have recorded the influence of flight rather than defining characters that may or may not be compatible with flight. And while reading through the literature, I found some very interesting work done on, among others, modern birds, in which workers have shown that particular properties that you can quantify in the cross-section of a bird bone provides at least some information on its flight, specifically on its flight style. So I was very interested to see if I could apply this to Archaeopteryx, and obviously with X-ray technique, we were able to get such data non-destructively, which obviously allows us to work with it in the first place. If I would have walked into a museum and asked people if I could kindly cut open their Archaeopteryx fossils, I think my career would have ended quite quickly.
Yeah, agreed. So what kind of things are you looking for in the cross-section of bones to tell you about how different animals would be able to fly?
So what in modern birds people have done, they've identified a few specific parameters. One of them being the amount of cross-sectional bone that's visible within the total cross-section of the bone. So I always say it you can best explain it as the quote-unquote hollowness of the bone. How large is the medullary cavity compared to the complete cross-section of the bone? Mm-hmm. A second thing is resistance against torsional forces. This is not particularly challenging to quantify, but it does appear to provide some information in modern birds. And another thing that we were not necessarily expecting, but something that we noticed immediately, is that the cross sections of the wing bones of Archaeopteryx are quite richly vascularized. And that was a bit remarkable because a study done 10 years ago, almost 10 years ago, on one of the specimens that we studied as well, suggested that the bone was nearly avascular, and when we compared the vascular density visible in cross-section with that of modern birds, then Archaeopteryx plots well within the range of modern birds. So although more research will be needed to sort of explore the implications of that, it is at least intuitively more consistent with an active mode of locomotion rather than a more passive mode suggested by avascular bone.
Well, Archaeopteryx is a fossil, and so if you're looking at the characteristics like the size of the hollow inside of the bone or the amount of pores, the vascularization, would you be able to directly infer that? Because surely the fossil must be flattened like a pancake. It must be crushed. Did you take that into account, or did you manage to correct for it in any way?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Indeed, Archaeopteryx fossils are compressed to a certain degree. Luckily, the isolated wing I referred earlier, I found has only been compressed by about 10%. So it actually, if you look at it from the outside, it's colloquially referred to as the chicken wing, and that's actually literally what it looks like as well. So I started working with that, and luckily we had really quite high-resolution data. So the contrast between the bone and the rock and the cracks was very clear. So, and also because we were focusing on a single two-dimensional cross-section, we were able to select those parts of the bone within the range of interest that were best preserved. So I started to work with this chicken wing fossil, and I found that it was relatively easy to cut out the cracks or cut out the pieces of bone between the cracks and then retro-distort it. The other two fossils were slightly more compressed and splintered in places, so it took me a bit more time. But again, the data quality was quite good, so I feel quite comfortable to have restored them conservatively. And then I was very fortunate to find later when I started to do my analysis, my statistical exploration, that actually all three specimens plot quite close together. So, of course, it's a restoration. The bones were deformed a little bit, but I feel a restoration is quite well done since we find a very common signal that they share with each other. And I always plot closer together than most other birds plot between each other. So in that regard, it was a bit challenging to begin with, but after we found the right procedure, I think we did a quite good job at retrieving the original geometry.
And so with that, what were you able to say about how Archaeopteryx flew?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Because we did our statistical exploration, the first thing that we tested was the influence of the relative thickness or thinness of the bones, if you will. I mounted a comparative data set of archosaurs. We have a few crocodiles, we have pterosaurs, we have bipedal dinosaurs, we have a quadrupedal dinosaur, and we have a wide range of birds with an equally wide range of locomotory strategies. And we just decided to let the statistics tell us where our archaeopteryx would plot. And the first thing we noticed after that is that this bone hollowness allies archaeopteryx exclusively with flying archosaurs. So it's bam smack in the middle of the range of hollowness, quote unquote, of modern birds. And it's actually also in the middle between the two pterosaurs that we tested. So with 95% confidence, we're quite comfortable to say that it was indeed flying. And then we started to look at the other parameter, the mass-corrected torsional resistance. This was a little bit more challenging to interpret because torsional resistance, and especially in the context of flight, you would expect to have adaptations scale a bit with body mass because it's inherently related with flight. And we did indeed see that although we did quite a good correction, we retained an ever so slight influence of body mass. So we focused specifically on things that were visible relative to this body mass signal. And if we then focused on birds, we found a little gradient that was still overlapping, but the gradient is there that goes from relatively low torsional resistance in birds that only fly incidentally or very small birds that use bounding flight, sort of a fugoid, senoid flight path. And then slightly elevated is a torsional resistance in birds that use prolonged flapping flight and flap gliding flight, such as a stork, for example. And then the highest relative torsional resistance was found in animals that use prolonged soaring flight, such as an albatross. And within this framework, we recovered Archaeopteryx quite closely and partially within the range of those burst flying birds. So birds that fly incidentally, if they don't have to fly, they will not fly. But if they need to evade from a predator, if they need to evade a predator, or if they want to cross some physical boundary or barrier, then they will take to the air. And then you have to think about animals like a pheasant, for example.
Throughout the history of the study of, or the origin of flight, there's always been a long-standing argument as to whether they were taking off from the ground or jumping off of trees and gliding down. So the ground up versus tree down argument. How does this fit into that?
Yes, you're absolutely right. This discussion has been going on for quite a few decades already. And although in sort of the last 15, 20 years, it's relaxed a little bit, people consider it to be a bit of a false dichotomy because today people are more and more starting to appreciate more intermediate hypotheses. There's some research done on wing-assisted incline running, which may provide sort of a hybrid approach to the two of them. But obviously, the essential question whether dinosaurian flight originated as an active mode of flight from the ground up or passive gliding from the trees down, that essentially still remains. And the validity of our study or the relevance of our study for this discussion really depends on how representative we think Archaeopteryx is for the very first dinosaurian flight. Because obviously Archaeopteryx is the oldest probable free flying dinosaur we know today. It doesn't mean that it truly represents among the oldest. And I would say that if we look at Archaeopteryx from an ecological point of view, it has quite long hind legs that seem quite well equipped with running, and morphological studies focusing on the proportion within the hind limbs also recover among birds that also tend to live on the ground mostly in open spaces. Again, ecology like what pheasants would have today. But yeah, we still have a bit of a ghost lineage because the placement of Archaeopteryx within meat-eating dinosaurs in general and within Maniraptora in particular is quite well established. But we're still not 100% sure where exactly it fits in. And then we come to another problem, which is that there's quite a lot of flight strategies of early flight strategies of dinosaurs that we see appearing from the latest Jurassic into the Cretaceous. And they might not all represent descendants from a single origin of flight. So that leaves open the hypothesis that dinosaurian flight may have had multiple origins. And although Archaeopteryx is intuitively or at least morphologically closer to modern birds than, for example, Microraptors, which are the potentially gliding four-winged animals from China, they're actually quite a different group as well. So if we would appreciate that fact alone, and if we infer that Microraptors were capable of gliding, then we're already looking at two independent origins of flight. And depending on which material will surface in the future, this might even become more complex.
That's actually really interesting. I'm not really a vertebrate person, but that's fascinating. Mm-hmm. Whether or not we've got this huge ghost range of flying dinosaurs, or if we've got multiple origins of flight. I mean, we're classically told that flight evolved four times, aren't we? Insects, pterosaurs, birds, and bats. But it might be insects, pterosaurs, birds, and birds, and birds, and birds, and bats. So that's fascinating.
Yeah, well, all modern birds obviously share a single origin. So per definition, they also have... No, that's okay. Yeah, but within dinosaurs, and I have to say that maybe the story is simpler after all, because our understanding of this, the phylogeny surrounding Archaeopteryx is still quite unclear and highly mobile. It really depends on which characters you select or which characters eventually will turn out to be informatic. But at the moment, there's still the possibility, and if you turn it around, I mean, if you look at Archaeopteryx and you look at the more inclusive clad of Archaeopteryx and modern birds, within that range, we at the moment still have a few animals that are clearly non-volant. So if we would take that at face value, then we will actually already see within Mesozoic dinosaurs, for example, that they would have gained the capability of flight, but would have returned to a non-volant ecology afterwards. And I want to stress that this all needs to be resolved with phylogeny to make some certain assertions based on this. But at the moment, it looks very interesting, and a few possibilities remain for now.
It sounds like a good postdoc for you.
I would love to. If I would get the chance to continue working with Archaeopteryx, then I would be extremely thrilled to do so.
Well, maybe someone's listening in right now, so give Dennis a postdoc.
That would be very nice.
So we've got all of this information about the bones, and we've used it to infer the flying ecology, but what else could we do with it?
Yes, that obviously depends on which questions you want to ask, because the method that we used potentially allows for more, and the technique we use is continuously improving. In that light, you must see that we're now working with data of three Archaeopteryx specimens. We scan them at the synchrotron. We try to get the maximum information from our data, but obviously we're trying to improve the acquisition parameters even more. So depending on if we want to focus more on the bone structure itself, if we want to focus more on the morphology, so to virtually excavate the fossils to be able to appreciate them from all sides, there's quite a few lines of research that are opened up with synchrotron tomography, because it obviously allows us to study the fossils without damaging them, and the curators are typically quite happy with that.
How was organizing all of this research done? I mean, you were using the synchrotron, which isn't easy or cheap to use, and you're using specimens of Archaeopteryx, which aren't easy or cheap to replace should you break them. So how did you bring it all together and convince the museum to let you use their specimens, and convince the synchrotron to let you put the specimens under some beam time?
Well, I'm a part of a larger team, obviously, including my supervisor, Paul Taffaro. So I was invited into the project when they already had done a few experiments. And with our earlier work, we were able to convince curators to either return when we had improved a method or to allow for new specimens to come over because we can show them that we were able to do neat things with it. But what you're saying is quite true. The fossils themselves are obviously also a bit of a challenge to work with because at all costs, we had to avoid changing or especially damaging them in any way. And when you do synchrotron tomography, you have to mount the fossil in a certain way that it doesn't move during data acquisition, which involves the sample being rotated on a sample stage. So, yeah, you can imagine that I've had a few interesting moments trying to get myself to mount them completely stationary without actually damaging them. But I have to say, looking back on it, it was a really nice experience. I'm very happy to say that no specimens were damaged during the course of our experiment. So it means that all our studies are reproducible because everything is exactly the way as it was before our scans. And I have to give my supervisor, Paul Taffereau, the credit for setting up the connections. And I also think that his reputation must have helped in securing the material and to get it into Grenoble for our experiments. And yeah, to answer your question about the beam time, because our experiments were also very important towards optimizing the methods that are used for tomography, and not even just for paleontology, but for awkward shapes in general. There was quite a bit of experimentation time available for that, in the sense that obviously future research will greatly benefit from the things that we have found out from a technical point of view. And I'm just the lucky man that gets to work with the data that results from it as well.
And you've just released the paper. I mean, it was like 3 or 4 days ago after this we recorded this episode. How has the reaction been from the press and the media in general?
Because it's Archaeopteryx, the attention was very, very great. I really had a lot of journalists talking to me. I had some colleagues reach out and congratulate me with the paper. And I have explained to to journalists that obviously Archaeopteryx is a very important animal for studying the origin of dinosaurian flight. And I tried to patiently explain them what we had discovered. But for some reason, the most questions I got were about our hypothesized model for flight mobility in Archaeopteryx. And I have been misquoted in saying that Archaeopteryx flew exactly like a pheasant, that it flew exactly like a butterfly did. And obviously, just studying the middle of two bones in the wing will not provide you all the context you require to resolve that. But yes, what we did try to do is unify the signal of active flight that we feel to have identified in the wing bones, and to unify this with the skeleton of Archaeopteryx. And in doing that, we have, again, through literature, came to the conclusion that indeed modern flight, or the flight of modern birds, is not permitted by its anatomy. So there's a few limitations that we try to take into account with providing at least a lead where future research could go in that respect. But, well, you know how it works. If science, and I really like the fact that our project got the attention it did, but I can obviously not be held responsible for conclusions or inferences that a journalist may have taken from it. But having said that, I was really, really quite happy and satisfied with the attention that it got. And in most cases, I was also quite happy with the coverage and the way our study was presented. So in that regard, I would say it was a big success.
And for you, you're defending your PhD in a few days. Has this been a bit of a nightmare to deal with when you're in the middle of preparing to defend, but yet you've got to speak to all of the media and whichever amateur podcasts come knocking at your door asking for interviews?
Well, you can also turn it around, right? I mean, this is the best practice I could get for my defense. And although my thesis includes another taxon altogether as well, so I will probably need to read up on that a little bit more before I do my defense, I would say that most angles or views on the project that we did and the conclusions that are drawn from it have been covered over the past few days. So I'm quite confident I would be able to reproduce that during the defense as well. And that's actually a bit of a comfort. And I think you will agree with me that if you get the opportunity to work with something so spectacular and to be able to get such nice results out there, then I would be crazy not to take my time and pay some attention to that as well. Because obviously the defense that I will do rests on this paper and another paper I've published, and they're already out there, so that will not change anymore. But in getting the story out there, we might be able to promote or provoke a bit more discussion, and that's something that I warmly welcome.
Okay, well, best of luck with the defense, and thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to do so.
Paleocast was brought to you by Dave Marshall, with Joe Keating, Laura Soule, Liz Martin-Silverstone and Caitlin Coleri. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, but the show now relies on contributions from you, the listeners. If you've liked this episode, please consider donating, and thanks to everyone that's helped out so far. We'd also like to thank the Ocean Collective for use of their music. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material to this episode and for our archive of past programmes. Subscribe to our Twitter feed at Paleocast and like us at facebook.com/paleocast to get all the latest news.